If there's nothing new under the sun, you know I'm going over. 'Cause there's nothing left to say. If they said it all here yesterday. If there's nothing new under the sun, I'm going over. 'Cause there's nothing left to do. If I ain't got a chance at something new. 'Cause maybe this is a test, a chance to prove I've got the stuff.
Okay, welcome back to Invent It Again. We're doing our second episode today and very excited about that. I'm here with Dr. Christian Slack.
Hi, everyone out there.
And we are really excited to be here. We don't record all of our conversations. We don't sit in here all day, but we do talk a lot. I'm very lucky to have Christian's time and access to his mind. And he was sharing something really interesting with me. We're always looking for good analogies for describing the various aspects of this because it's really complicated. There's lots of moving parts, and it's really good if we can help you, the listener, understand things a little bit easier. So I really like this analogy of rock, paper, scissors. We've all played rock, paper, scissors. There's even a Japanese game show where there's big money on the line playing rock, paper, scissors. You can take this very seriously. But there's another version of rock, paper, scissors that is taken very seriously with a lot of money on the line that plays itself out in the business world. And I thought this was really interesting that your disclosure of your process, of your improvements and what you claim as novel is like choosing scissors and making your often very expensive pair of scissors only to find out later that it can be defeated by essentially free rocks, the prior art that exists already in the global stock of knowledge, that when they come at you with scissors, like in the olden days of feudal Japan, the samurai would go and have his brand new sword made and look for the nearest peasant to test it out on. It's quite gruesome, but the peasants would actually eat rocks to disappoint the samurai when they would break their swords on their belly. And I'm pretty grim, but not necessarily where I'd want to be living. But if we could just talk a little bit about, it feels very much that this idea of the patent as sword, which has been described, you know, if we swap that out with scissors, it's a costly process. It's a lot about the status of hanging this thing on your wall next to your coat of arms, you know, your corporate brand or your personal brand. Let's just talk a little bit about, unpack that a little bit for us, because I think this is great if we keep this analogy nice and simple. The rock beats scissors. You always know that they've got scissors because they've disclosed it.
The background to that is, Matt, it's quite widely said by people in the IP industry and others that a patent is like a sword. And in order to make your money out of it, and you don't sit back and not use it, you wield it and you exploit it and you take it to other people who are in your territory, right? So it's it's a very aggressive position to take. And, you know, for some things which are very novel and that people are wanting to compete in a particular space, then it's a valid process. But it is very expensive, and it's expensive to go through the process, and it takes a long time to apply for a patent, have the patent drawn up, go through the examination process, pay all this money out, and if you don't exploit it, then you effectively wasted money. And we talked about this before. You know, if you go 20 years without licensing or using your patent to stop somebody else from doing what you're doing or what you're trying to do, then really there's no value in the patent itself.
It's a very expensive wall hanging.
That's right.
Like your sword next to your coat of arms.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's seen by a lot of people that you have to have this, that the patent is essential to move forward with something. And that's also, it's an indicator that investors sometimes use or quite often use. So if something's got a patent, then all of a sudden, a lot of people's minds, that makes it a jump from being not necessarily uninvestable, but to being more investable because it has a patent. Right. And so there's a lot of value tied up in the shiny thing, right? So the essence is, and where this differs from the traditional game of rock, paper, scissors, is you obviously don't know what your opponent is going to put forward because it'd be very much a one-way one-way fight. Yeah, so the major difference is that when you apply for a patent from the examiner examines that, and the patent is granted as in exchange for the disclosure of your patent, your invention.
Right.
And so at the point at which your patent is applied for and published and granted, you are disclosing your choice of the weapon. In this case, it's likely to be the scissors because people see it as a sword and it's a very expensive component out of all of the scissors, paper, rockets. It's probably the most aggressive, but it's also the most handcrafted and expensive one to go through. So that's the major difference. So what we're saying is, look, in this game, we can see what hand people have already put forward, and we can go out and look for the prior disclosures.
Which are the rocks in your rock, paper, scissors analogy.
Absolutely, which will undo, if you like, or blunt those scissors at a very, very cheap cost.
And this kind of ties back to something that we were talking about in terms of productivity and in terms of our small team New Zealand, our 5 million strong team here, and about really being frugal about our resources. There's no more frugal way to go into battle than to pick up a bunch of free rocks to defeat the scissors you know are there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this comes back to our overarching belief in what people call fast failure. So it's processing things very quickly, very early on, and understanding the lie of the land, understanding what other hands people can wield, and providing a defense against those. And a defense so that you can go out and you can have your freedom to operate, which means you can go out there and do what you want to do without other people attacking you with scissors.
So how do we apply this to our own lives, to our collective lives as a town, as a city, as a country, as a planet? It seems like there's a bit of an answer shaping up here, and it's that we really need to increase the total number of people who are not only motivated to do this searching, this rigor, but they have the tools to do it, they have the habit of doing it, to access the value and exploit the value in that existing global stock of knowledge. We've already started to set out some principles, and I think that's really going to help us organize some of this thinking. But just specifically, what are we looking for in a looker? Someone who's helping us play snap. You mentioned a good general knowledge.
Really important, and this is an ideal person, which is always very difficult to come across, but having someone with a good understanding of how things work, historically things that have happened, the dynamics of industries and markets and these sorts of things, so a bit of history, and also the ability to understand language. So what we find is that when we're looking for something, something is going to be called something very different if it's in a different application or different technology.
Or a different era.
A different era, different market. And
or a different language.
Period of time, yeah. and all of these things, which are really important not to be fearful of. So it's very common. I know a lot of very bright people with lots of very high-level degrees and qualifications, and for the most part, if you're challenged with finding something new, if it's not part of their core knowledge, they feel quite
out of their depth,
reticent to do that. Because they don't know anything about it. And that's a key part of what we're talking about, is actually the ability to say, look, I can understand things. I have the capacity to understand and comprehend and interpret, but I don't know very much.
We're going to come back to this a lot, but we talk about the ego a lot when we were talking about this in private. And I'm getting better at kind of expressing that to others and making that clear. This is about the ego and about controlling it. When somebody says they're out of their depth, they're just saying, I'm not comfortable with not being in control in the way that I'm used to being.
Yes. Yeah. And you find that in certain contexts, there are always in life hierarchies of people. And what's interesting here is that the ego is driven by people's self-belief, and it's very important to have an ego and enable you to react to things. The danger comes in terms of novelty and in terms of understanding what's gone on before, is that people use their own retained knowledge as a proxy for the global stock of knowledge. And so you find a world...
Don't trust your gut.
Yeah, absolutely. Do not trust your gut. You find that even world experts in their field won't know everything, even in that field themselves.
So be curious like a child. Don't let your ego drive you. Now, I want to come back to thanking the ego, because we've been bagging on it, and it has a very important function at the very beginning in the ideation phase. And we'll come back to that. But we were talking about the traits that we're looking for, this ideal looker. You also mentioned, so you've talked about languages, you talked about general knowledge, you talked about the ability to understand things. I think that looking at these pictures, I've known some people who, when they look at a picture, have a very difficult time conceiving of it as a solid. I don't know how to describe that, but spatial understanding when it comes to a physical product. Obviously, this isn't for software or for non-physically engineered objects, but a lot of the stuff that we look at is, and a lot of the stuff that you look at is. So maybe the ability to actually conceive of something that's drawn in two dimensions in three dimensions, so you can really understand its function.
Absolutely. And these things are developed over time and experience and trial and error and all those things come. It's a learning process to be able to do those things. And typically for a lot of people, I mean, you may be talking in usual texts around graphs and bar charts and all these sorts of things. And I know a lot of people who would be completely, utterly put off by a chart and numbers and yep. equations and all the rest of it. And equally about the words as well, have problems with reading a massive amount of data, or in fact having lots and lots of tabs open on a computer at one time, trying yep. to figure out what the similarities are between one thing and another. So it's a capacity thing, but it's also a learnt thing as well.
Which brings me to the thing that you mentioned before, which is the idea of having a good teacher, somebody who's really good at simplifying things, not only for others, but first for themselves, and maybe even tech writers, people who have to take the engineer's drawings and all the engineer's jargon and probably unedited raw thoughts and turn them into a step-by-step process that a layman can use it.
Absolutely. And if you think about it, if you're using a search engine, we talk about Google as a, Google itself and also the Google patents website and search engine. What you're putting into that is effectively your synopsis. Your search term is a synopsis of what you think you're looking for. And so you're only really going to put two or three words into there at the start. Mm-hmm. And then you might start refining things. You might find somebody's name. You might find a company name. You might find a piece of terminology that you weren't aware of in the past and want to use that. You might look in another source of information. So you might take information from your Google search and find a science paper and think, oh, that's an interesting way of describing that. I'm going to put that into the patent search engine, and likewise. And there's lots of different silos of information. But it's very, very important that you can simplify it. If you put in a 20-word search term, you're going to be unnecessarily restrictive that everything has to have all those words in it in order for it to come out.
And look, so, there's nothing out there.
Absolutely.
I put my entire paper into that one little box. Nothing came back. I put quotes around it.
Absolutely.
It must be new.
So it's trying to be search broadly, generate a lot of information, and then make sense of that information.
Great. So again, I think we're describing what we look for in an ideal looker. And again, just the looker is those helping us. It's what we do when we play IP Snap. It's anybody on our side of the team trying to find the ways in which the idea that was submitted is not new. So we did talk about how maybe teachers are really good at this, at boiling things down, tech writers. But again, this can be anybody, and we want it to be you. So please consider coming along and helping us to do that. We do have a much more lofty goal. I think we share this goal of having a population, an entire population of people who feel wrong about asking for resource before rigor. This is a cultural shift, and it's only possible when people have the skills and the understanding and the motivation to do so. And we're not talking about having the government, for example, centrally pick a winner that is going to be the funnel for all ideas, such that that winner can take shares in and own and somehow create a privileged position and an advantage in a market. We want to see the leadership that requires the process, regardless of who's delivering it, as long as that process is clear. We make rules about disclosure and disclaimer in information memorandums. It may be in line with what we're trying to achieve, that we put rules in there about rigor.
Business people from the 80s through to the present day will have heard about stage gates and processes and panels of people and committees that make decisions, and these all rely on gut feel. And unfortunately, having three or four tranches of gut feel doesn't make it okay. And I think that's a really key thing. The other thing I was going to go back on, and what we talked about, was that the search process needs to be very, very iterative. And the old adage, if at first you don't succeed, try again, applies, simply because if you don't find something in your first iteration of looking, then that doesn't mean that that thing doesn't exist. And that's a very tempting process to go through, a very superficial process to justify your gut feel position.
Bringing that back to principles, it's the first principle that I listed in what I'm working through that I'll talk about at the end of the show, which is be as curious as a child, and we'll come back to that. Now, I said that we bag on the ego a bit. We warn about the dangers of your ego. It's really important not to villainize it overmuch. It does serve an important function. Every human needs a healthy ego. And I think it's important to just thank your ego as an ideator. It's really important to thank your ego for its service in sparking your action. You know, your behold moment is very difficult to come by if you haven't got a feeling that you're the first, and a feeling that you're special, and feeling that you're worthwhile. So we want to really thank the ego for all that. But when it finally gets to the point that we're talking about, which is assessing an idea, it's really time to then put the ego to bed. Nightlight, little ego, you deserve a rest. If you don't, if you let it continue to drive your actions, after the initial spark of the idea, it will most likely steer you wrong. Don't trust that gut.
I'd agree with that entirely, Matt. In order to have an idea, we need to be able to have our own experiences, our own stock of knowledge. I know we keep referring to the stock of knowledge. And if you look at, for example, something that people may well be aware of, at the field days, they have an inventor's tent or exhibition, and all of those inventions, without fail, are caused by quite often farmers, but quite often members of the public who have a problem. You know, they've fallen off a ladder and they don't want to do it again, so they develop a solution. And solution and problem solving are driven by ego. It's what you know, and this is how I would solve this problem based on what I know. Tends not to be an awful lot about what other people have done in the past, unless they're an obvious candidate for that. So you can go up to Mitre 10 and you can buy a ladder, yeah. Stand off and think, well, actually, that solved my problem. Then that's equally you're solving your problem, but you're using somebody else's idea or product.
And if you'd have been aware of that in your day-to-day life anyway, you wouldn't likely be submitting that as an idea unless you were intentionally trying to defraud people out of their money.
Coming up with ideas that are outside your own sphere. And in fact, a lot of the really good inventions, the major leap forward, are from people who are not experts in their field. Larger companies and experts in the field tend to develop things which are quite close and incremental to what they already do, and that's the nature of big business and the nature of those people who are experts in a narrow field. So it's really important to have the ego, it's really important to have the idea, but the next step is the most important one in terms of being productive. So that's getting your idea out there and working, and we've talked about in the past the definition of innovation being invention plus exploitation. And it's the first, after you come up with the idea, which is the first part of your invention, it's then really, really important to kind of put your ego to one side, or you'll recognize that your own stock of knowledge is not a proxy for the global stock of knowledge and everything that's been done in the past and everywhere else. And for some people, that's very hard. For children, it's not particularly hard at all, because they don't know this thing. They don't know stuff, so that's fine, and we'll get on and do it. But the more senior you become, and if you're a professor in a university or at the top of the hierarchy, and you're the world's guru in your particular field, if somebody comes along to that person and says, "I've got this great idea, what do you think?" And that guru turns around and says, "Oh, you know, that looks really interesting. I haven't seen anything like that before." You assume that that person's stock of knowledge is exactly the same and covers off the global stock of knowledge. And the reality is that it doesn't. So there's an important step once the idea is there, which is, how has somebody else overcome this problem in the past? And why is my way of overcoming this problem different and better in whatever way that might be, in terms of cheaper, faster, and more available, or whatever? And that's the really important step that we need to take, because if we continue to rely on our own stock of knowledge and our own self-belief and our ego, then we're never going to see these other things that have maybe happened 100 years ago. And that example we gave before with the peat thing was 100 years ago, roughly.
Yep.
The reality there psychologically is, even if you're a world expert in your field, is you will really only be aware of what has gone on in your field during your working lifetime. There, of course, is steps back. People understand history and where things have been developed. But the guy who's building the briquette machine, and mm-hmm. it could be an international company that makes, you know, waste recovery, they wouldn't know what somebody did when they were making a peat briquette back in 1924, and why would they? Right. But our assumption is that they, if they're the guru and they say it's new, then it's new. And so this is where the things start to get expensive, because of reinvention or inventing again. And it's also the point at which the person has had confirmation, if you like, or affirmation that their idea is great, and that they should maybe go down the patent road and all these sorts of things. And we talked about this idea of the patent as the pair of scissors, if you like. So it's very expensive, very long, you know, it takes a long time to craft it, a long time to go through the process until it's actually in its physical shiny form and you can hang the certificate on your wall. And the problem is that people can often find, because you've only used your own stock of knowledge, people can find the rocks looking around, scouting around in the global stock of knowledge, looking for obscure, sometimes obscure things, sometimes not so obscure. And the problem with that is that you'll have spent a lot of money getting to where you are, thinking that you've got your very nice pair of scissors. And the reality is, if you want the patent, then you will be told you'll have to get a patent, and you have to go to an attorney, and the attorney will make you, or draft the pattern and effectively make your scissors.
And it makes perfect sense that if you go to a place that sells scissors, you're probably going to walk out with a pair.
Absolutely. Even if it's not the best option for you.
It can be defeated in battle with the rocks in the pockets of your competitors. It's time again for a bit of IP snap. We have a submission through the website today from a young man named Otto. And we're very excited that we're getting our youngest submitter to date. He's 7 years old. And he's asked, I'll read this out exactly as he submitted. The problem that he's talking about is, I want to understand what I'm seeing when I'm walking in the world. A pretty profound problem to handle. Next, we ask, who has this problem? And he's talking about himself. I'm Otto, and I'm 7 years old, and I spend a lot of time walking in nature or in the city or wherever, and often I'm not sure exactly what I'm looking at and would like to be able to identify it and learn some basic information. And his solution is that he wants an app called, and he's even got a name for this, PictureTell. And PictureTell is exactly that. It takes a picture of something, and then the information from the picture will tell me what I'm seeing. So, for example, if I take a picture of a tree, this app will tell me that I'm looking at a puriri tree, a tree native to New Zealand. Other known solutions? He says, I'm seven. I don't know of any other solutions. We'll get back to that in a minute, Otto, but I love your honesty. Next, we ask about jargon, technical terms that we might not know. There's no really technical terms here. Just picture is the picture that he's talking about capturing with the application on the device. And the telling is the information that he's getting back. And is it profitable or are there savings compared to other solutions? Savings is based on the amount of frustration I will remove from my life by not knowing what I'm looking at. Very insightful. Just to clarify for Otto and anyone else who might like to submit an idea through inventedagain.com, it's important that in this section you put those things that your competitors are doing so that we can compare the costs of doing it their way versus the costs of doing it your way. So let's ask the computer to kick off a 15-minute IP snap. Computer, can you please go? Take it away, Christian.
Okay. Oh, great that Otto's found a problem that he has, and that's the start of all these great ideas. And it's pretty broad, isn't it? He's looking to understand exactly what he's looking at and he's walking in the world. As a sort of a hardened adult in this, I can see that there's opportunities to have a distributed image capture system that could be used for all sorts of things, for other people and for traffic issues and crime stoppers and all sorts of other things in there. So,
and this might help. I don't know if you know about this library called TensorFlow. It's this is an open source, free. There's a free to use version of this platform from Google, and it's AI image recognition and analysis kit, essentially. So we know that there is at least a building block for these applications before looking to see if there are any in the market.
Absolutely. And he's been, he's given us an example, which is great, Matt. So I think if we go with the taking a picture of a tree, maybe, or a plant or something like that, then maybe that's where we should start looking at this. It's good. It's great that he's able to say, I don't know of any other solutions, because that allows us to sort of jump in there fairly quickly and see what there is. He's not trying to say, I've got this tiny, narrow little space and this problem that I think should be done, and we've got the opportunity to look at it in a broad sense. So,
to that end, did I beat you to it?
Yeah, go on.
Picture this plant identifier. Does it even have the name? Is that what he... Did he say picture... Picture, no, he said picture tell. But picture, this is a plant identifier app in the App Store from Glority Global Limited. Identify, cure, explore, share. Identifies 1,000,000+ plants every day with 90%, 98% accuracy. Better than most human experts.
Interesting.
So that's one piece of his, obviously he's not content to just have trees, but we've got a good basis here.
We've got I can see being a not a very sophisticated gardener and knowing the identity of all sorts of things, it'll be really useful. I've seen on here as well, just on Google, that I think I put in plant identification application, and the post came up from the plant guide. And it's called the Best Plant Identification App. So it's got a few on here. There's lists are Flower Checker, Nature Gate. So it says it allows you to identify your plant with a database of 700 species. And the Flower Checkers uses real botanists. Now, you see, here's the thing, they're using people in the background, I think, so they must be, they're using experts, an expert system rather than an automated and machine vision system.
So. Are you sure that that's not that the experts are training the system? Because I can't imagine that would be practical, scalable.
This says here, it says your picture will be identified by an international team of experts. Because of this, it may be the most accurate of the apps.
Right. So is it free?
I don't know, actually. It's called Flower Checker, one word.
Interesting. While you're doing that, I've kind of diverted away from the plants, and I'm finding something called CamFind. Have you ever wanted to search the physical world? Enter CamFind, the world's most accurate mobile visual search engine, powered by CloudSight.
Interesting. There's another one on this sort of plant identification. It says Google Goggles. It says, although not directly plant-related, Google Goggles works with the user taking a photograph. And if the app recognises what is in the picture, it will offer up suggestions and information of what it may be. So that sounds like the broader version.
Application. I wonder if they I see now here Google Lens for everything. Have they, sometimes they'll change the branding of what they're looking at. Yep. This was 2019, May 2019.
Yep, this plant guide one is 2017, so yours is probably more.
They may have rebranded. Google Lens. Otto, you're really onto something. Some of the big players are really, really seeing that this is a problem that a lot of people have, and that's awesome that you've identified one. I think with confidence we could say that'll be our snap, because we found not only your specific example where we can do something to identify a plant, but also other objects. I do feel pretty confident in saying that we've got a snap now. We'll look at some of these opportunities. I'd love to talk to you in greater depth about, once you've had a chance to look at these things, because this is an important part of the process too. First of all, computer, I think we have a snap.
I think it's really interesting as well, Matt. We're calling our process patent snap, and what Otto's really talking about is image snap.
Yes, right.
So it's intelligence associating what's in an image with something with data that's contained in the background and the app can access.
So right.
Yeah, it's good. It's good parallels with that.
On some level, he may have seen that in his mind when we described the show to him. This may have been inspirational. It's a very important reminder. One of the most valid criticisms of our process is that we'll always keep coming back to that cartoon about crushing dreams. We are not about crushing people. We're not about discouraging people. Here we've found this IP snap. We've shown that there are some existing things out there that look like they solve the problem in a very similar way to what Otto described. And that's not meant as discouragement. Either Otto can let it to rest and say, oh, okay, well, it's been done. I can go and use that. It's immediately valuable to him in his walk through the woods today, not in 6 months or a year from now. He could have another inspiration, because kids never have a shortage of ideas. We only ever learn the fear of a shortage of ideas. That's not something we're born with. We're naturally curious and constant idea machines if you talk to children about this stuff. So I have no doubt that he'll put a second and a third through if he feels like this space is a bit too crowded. But there's another option there, which is to pivot, which is to look at what the competitors are doing and seeing if he can find some niche that isn't being covered. Perhaps if he was really into gaming, he might be able to take a snapshot of somebody playing a game, take a snapshot of their screen, and identify the game and where he can get it. Just throwing one off the cuff, there's probably other ones.
Even reviewing some of the stuff, so he's out on a walk and he's taking some imagery or video, and he might look at it later and think, oh, what was that tree in the background over there, or what was that animal that we saw,
right.
Oh, I didn't see that at the time,
right?
And here's something that really interesting. So
right, rather than just using the app to take an image in that moment. Yeah, great. All sorts of ways that idea can be explored, and a new niche and a new differentiator can be found. So thanks so much, Otto. That was an awesome IP snap. I enjoyed that one, and I hope that it piques your curiosity and pushes you to find either a way to niche down with this one, or that we hear your next one very soon. So we got an idea through the idea test system at inventedagain.com, and it started a pretty interesting investigation. I just found this kind of fascinating. A system for making building blocks out of waste plastic. So this is a local man with lots of plastic bags, plastic waste, and wishing he could chuck that into something that would turn it into something useful. And he was thinking about smaller bricks, Lego type bricks, maybe something for the kids, which he has a couple of, and Legos are expensive, so any which way to cut costs on entertaining and educating our kids, but also just environmentally more a sound way than just importing more plastic toys. But it got me looking for a story that I recalled about someone who had come up with some technology around making these types of blocks for building homes and building other buildings. So after a little bit of a search, I found this man named Peter Lewis on the Stuff website around some problems that he had commercializing this IP of his and the acquisition of that technology by another company. And yeah, it's quite an intrigue-laden story. But let's just have a look together, Christian. I'm not going to run this one as an IP snap because it's not contemporary, but I think it's illustrative of a lot of interesting things about this process, about disputes around IP, but also just around looking at what a patent claim is and the granting of patent claims and the interdependencies of a very complicated system of recording what people have actually done. So can you dive in with me a little bit on this one and talk us through what happened in this case?
Sure, Matt. That's fairly new to me, but I think it's really important to think about process and also the time frame this has occurred. This is some time ago, and the really interesting thing here is before we start looking at the prior art and all those sorts of things is actually looking at the process that somebody's gone through from having an idea to getting a patent, mm-hmm. presumably seeking investment, getting external investment. The company that's been formed has since acquired the technology, moved offshore, I believe, to the States, yep. and there's been a falling out. And, of course, these types of stories are fairly common in this arena. There's a lot of people with their ideas and they're wanting to hold on to their IP. With investment comes dilution, if you like. With that dilution also tends to come a relinquishing of control, and that relinquishing of control can result and often does result in the inventor and the founder no longer being with the business. And the guy's made some very interesting comments here about the fact that the technology is not as good as he's said it was, or not as good as he thought it was, and that there's some improvements that he can come back and make it all work again. I think an overall thing here, before we get into the technical detail, an overall view on it as well, is that often these things, because they move about between the idea and the technology and the market and the exploitation or the commercialization of these things, it's really useful to have something of this nature because you can look back and say, this has been going on for a long, long time, 20 years. And when we look at IP, patents generally have a lifetime if they're fully maintained, and that means you've got to keep paying money to keep them active and live of 20 years. And so...
And just as a bit of background, you know, this article that I found was from 2018. So we're not talking about end of 2018, so nearly 2019. Yeah. And as you pointed out on the patent itself that was lodged by Mr. Lewis and currently assigned to this company with which he had a bit of a dispute, it looks like, by Fusion Incorporated. The anticipated expiration is 2021. Right. So this is next year. This whole story, the application story, looks like it begins in 2000.
So you've got to think about value, I suppose. So you've got to think that this is just without looking into the detail, making a few assumptions. But if you've got technology and you've gone to get a patent, that means you've disclosed it publicly. Mm-hmm. And that means the clock's ticking. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't managed to successfully commercialize it, and it doesn't appear to be a product on the market, there's a few vague websites and things.
I couldn't find something to buy. I couldn't find even the output of the machine to buy as a construction, you know, somebody who's keen on making something environmentally sound. And
got to wonder the value of going down the patent road, because if it expires in a year's time and you still haven't made any money out of it, you still haven't commercialized it, the costs of doing that are very high. Mm. All the costs of patenting, you're never going to recover them because it then becomes free for everyone to use. So that's the first point. The second point is, have people been infringing this patent over the years? And there's no evidence on here, in any case, about whether people have tried to copy this technology or they've infringed it or whatever. So,
and that is something that usually does show up in your search, right?
And the other thing is, presumably because of the cost of patenting and the like, when it was first applied for, there was patents applied for in China and the States and Australia, Mexico, Canada, Europe and Taiwan and South Africa, and also in New Zealand, the priority date as well. So really only the US on Google Patents website, which we're looking at now, it's really only the US and South Africa that are still current, maybe Mexico. So gone and paid for all those patents in all those countries, and then you...
And can I just bring up here a personal experience that I've had a couple of times where at this point in a project, you may run out of resource because you spent it all on your patent. That pair of scissors is very expensive to make, and it may have drained the resources that you would have otherwise put into finding an older piece of art and just realizing the value in commercializing something that was already there.
Because the patent is almost expired, the opportunity to make money from the patent, not from the product, but from the patent, is coming to a close. Mm-hmm. And so that opportunity has really been lost because you can't license the patent to somebody else. You can't use it as collateral or anything else. So,
and that's probably not a strategy anyway, if he's already downplaying its value.
Well, that's what he is now, yeah.
Which you know, is interesting psychologically in and of itself.
And so the other thing is, one is that the patent's coming up to expiry, and that means that at that point that it does expire, anybody can use this technology. Like I said, we're not looking at the detail at the moment, we will in a minute. And then the other thing is, if you've only got a patent in the States, then there's an opportunity for people to use this technology. If it was amazing, they'd be out there finding a way to achieve a similar outcome by getting around the patent. It doesn't appear that there have been other companies that are using this approach. So, and there's no history of litigation, so that sort of covers that off. So it's the question is, do other people see that there's an opportunity in doing this? Or if not,
why not?
Yes, absolutely. These are questions we've got to ask. With a lot of these historical things, if you're looking at a new technology, you can look back at these older things and say, look, these people try to do this 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and it didn't work commercially then. Mm. What are you doing now that is going different. To make it different, and how is the market and the technology and the requirements changed that is going to make this successful for you? Mm. And those are the questions that I'd be asking anybody trying to get into that field. So probably really easy to look at this and say, you know, what is the point of difference that's been patented? Because I think that's really a useful thing to look at. And the predominant claim, which is called the independent claim, is a method for forming an article. So it could be any article. But
now, just backing up just in terms of definitions, yeah. we'll have listeners to whom all of this will be absolutely new. I hope you're listening to those people as well. Claims. A claim is a claim of novelty. This is what they claim is new.
That's exactly right.
Just to clarify
noun. A claim is the important part of the patent, because those are the things that can be infringed. So if you look at a patent, and if you've never looked at one, try and find one. Just type a US patent and it'll find you something. It'll go onto Google or look for something that's familiar, like the Lego block patent or something like that, and it'll give you a document. And on that document is the name of the inventor and the date. And for newer patents and US patents, there are a list of citations, so they're things that they refer to in their patents, so they're what they're trying to differentiate from. And then there's a description of the invention, which gives some of the background and some of the why, and there's often drawings and descriptions of the drawings. And after all, the description is what are called the claims, and the claims are paragraphs. They are the claim to novelty, or the claim to the patent, which has to be novel. It's the claims that can be infringed. So if you're looking at somebody else's patent, you have to infringe all of the claim in order for it to be it. So the claim contains what are called limitations. So if we've got a Lego brick, would be a rectangular shell with protrusions, the little dotty bits on the top that are evenly spaced in a pattern. And probably the most important part and the limitation would be the web on the underside into which those protrusions lock when you put the bricks together. And so it's important to remember with the patent that it describes and it claims how something works. It doesn't. You can't claim an outcome. So you can't say, I patented a...
What about that nanotubes example?
Yes.
So I didn't invent nanotubes, because they could even occur in nature.
Yes.
I invented a process by which one can make a nanotube.
Absolutely, yes. Nanotubes are very, very small tubes of all sorts of materials, but particularly carbon. And they're formed using particular conditions, and they provide some pretty substantial physical properties that are useful. And so the reality is, though, that people have been making carbon and carbon fiber and carbon fabrics and other things, processing materials to make carbon materials for a long, long time. And so the argument there, or the position, is that if somebody made something in the 1800s, they wouldn't have known, and they wouldn't have been calling it a carbon nanotube, because one is they couldn't see it and they wouldn't know what it was. But if they protected the process of making a carbon object using these particular conditions that may well have produced carbon nanotubes, then the understanding is that the claims of a later patent, which claims that something called a carbon nanotube is inherent. So it's inherent that the person in the 1800s would have made carbon nanotubes, even mm-hmm. if they didn't know they had. There's a lot to take in with these things, but that if we just go...
Repetition. Absolutely. I'll just keep asking the same question every time we talk, and eventually we'll all get it. But just bringing that back to the nanotube, that idea of this is about the process, not the outcome, that you're making claims for in your patent, and that a claim is about what you claim to be novel about your process of making this outcome. But that limitation is a narrowing. Would that be to say a narrowing of claims by providing more detail?
Yes, okay, exactly.
Which brings us to one of my original questions before we started having this chat, which is looking at this process and looking at the breadth of these claims, which look quite broad when you're talking about forming plastics in a mold that gets pressed, like a car crusher. We've all seen a car crusher. Do you want to talk a little bit about a different way, increasing your limitations, narrowing down further, being more honest about the state of the art, and how that impacts on this process?
Yes, when we talk about limitations, what this means actually is that there's more detail. The more detail there is in the claim, the narrower the scope, because every sentence that you write in there, every different aspect of that makes the thing more specific. And what that means actually historically is that the oldest patent that you find that relates to a technology is always the broadest. And things that happen after that are additional limitations that people add onto the end.
Mm-hmm. Refinements?
Yes. Yeah. It can be that the refinements are fairly narrow, and people have in their minds sometimes strategies for just getting the patent. So if they put a really narrow point of difference into the claim, then they will get the patent, but it might not make it particularly valuable in terms of the scope of the claim as well. So,
which makes perfect sense, you know. If you could claim something as broad as electrical reticulation, which obviously at some point someone did, you know, that's incredibly valuable. And as time goes on, that becomes commoditized.
In a generic sense, when you look at the claim, probably in most cases, a substantial part of the claim is not new. It's just starting from the building block and the plastic webbing. I'm talking about the Lego brick here. And so sometimes you look at these things and think, well, what is it that's new about this thing here? And it's quite pertinent to this particular thing. So just running through the claim, we've got it in front of us here, and I'll read it through once and then go back and explain what it all means. It says, a method of forming an article comprising the steps of 1, introducing into a chamber material to be formed containing a sufficient amount of thermoplastics material to bind the material together. 2, compressing the material within the chamber in one direction and then in a second direction, transverse to the first direction, so that it occupies a reduced volume. 3, inputting sufficient energy to melt sufficient thermoplastics material substantially throughout the material to bind the material together when cooled. And 4, releasing an article produced from the chamber. So we're just going to do this one claim. So it's a method of forming an article. So it's a way of making something.
So it has. If we stop there, this might be overly broad.
Yes. Yeah. So that's fairly broad, and it has steps. So the 1 step is putting material to be formed into a chamber to form the article, whatever it is, and that contains an amount of thermoplastic. So thermoplastic is a material that when you heat it, you can change its shape. So you're putting this waste...
Which includes all of our single-use bags.
That's right, yes. So they're introducing the thermoplastics material, or a sufficient amount of thermoplastics to bind the material together. So it doesn't have to be all plastics. It could be any other filler material. It could be dirt, or it could be anything at all.
Which is exciting because waste generally is, you know, mixed up. It's not clean, it's mixed with...
That's right. And so they're putting their stuff in there, and they're putting their thermoplastics in and putting that into the chamber. And then the second part is that they're squashing it. So they're compressing the material within the chamber in one direction. So maybe lengthways, it's not specific, but it could be one way. And then in a second direction, which might be widthways, which is transverse to the first direction. So that's got to be transverse in one way. So
meaning at right angle.
Yeah. So it occupies a reduced volume. So it's just like a compactor process.
As we talked about, car crusher or a...
Yep. That's right. So it's compressing the material in two directions, so in a first and a second direction, and it's specific there that it's doing it in one direction first and then in a second direction rather than squashing it from
two directions at once.
Two directions at once, that's right. And then it's saying we're putting sufficient energy to melt the thermoplastic material substantially throughout the material to bind the material together when cooled. So what that means is that they're baking the thing, or applying heat in some way to melt the bits of thermoplastic so that it becomes a composite block.
From reading this, it doesn't state clearly whether this is happening at the same time. So you could read this and it was the compression happened, and then it's inherent in the definition of steps.
That's right.
So if they had, they would have made step two the compression and the heating had they done it simultaneously. Okay,
that's right.
You know, this language is important, and the way that it's structured, you could easily miss that these are sequential rather than simultaneous.
Absolutely, and you know you could also say you could do, you know, that there's maybe more claims I haven't had a look down the bottom. Maybe something where those steps have changed, so you could maybe heat the stuff in your original size cavity first, and then compress it, and those sorts of things. And then step number four, which we haven't covered, is just releasing an article produced in the chamber, so spitting out your object. Mm. So it's not totally clear from that where the crux of the novelty is. You know, what is it that they're saying? Is it the order of the steps, or is it the things? So we've had a look in the background and looked at the progress of the patent through the patent office, and really the crux of this is that they're compressing the material within the chamber in one direction and then in a second direction, transverse to the first direction. So that's the critical part of it now.
And you were finding that by clicking on the global dossier link in the external links under that main heading of the patent. If you're looking along at the patents, I will put this link in the description for this episode. And just under where the application events are, at the bottom of that you get external links. And we just went to the global dossier, just so everybody knows where this is coming from.
There's various links on... This is all from Google Patents, so it's all readily accessible, no payment required. So these are all links that you can look through there. You can look at all the citations that were made by the inventor and by the patent examiner. You can see who it's been cited by. You can see what's called legal events, so it's sort of the things that have happened in terms of the ownership of the patent being transferred.
Which is where you learned that there wasn't a real commercial hotbed of activity of people trying to litigate this, because there was a huge commercial opportunity. You would see generally a commercial opportunity and competition has evidence in legal action.
Absolutely. And also it tends to be front and center in publicity as well. So there'd be people taking action against other people for infringing their rights. So we haven't really looked at the market, haven't looked at the other people that are doing similar things. So, it's a pretty simple patent in terms of the claim, and that it's pretty simple what they're hanging their hats on in terms of novelty.
But it wasn't so clear from the original patent itself, which is a point that I really want to get to, which is that the impression that one gives when one lodges that patent in such a broad way, instead of this being a very, very short patent that says Cargill, because they keep referencing this patent from Cargill, did this. And what we figured out that's better is to, after you've done that first compression in one direction, we can get a much better result by compressing in a second direction. If that's all it was, this could be a very, very short patent. And I guess I'm kind of interested in that.
Well, the psychology, and it is a psychology thing again, is that if you're going to do something that's new, then you need to know what other people have done. Mm. But you can, and people do often, speculate. And so they, instead of doing the work themselves and saying, this is what the other person did, and this is what we're doing, this is exactly what we're claiming, and this is the benefit that we're putting forward, they will rely on the examiner to find things. Now, the examiners are overworked, and they can't afford to spend a long time looking at the prior art around these things. And so they will do what we're doing here and have an extremely quick look.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, the examiners are experienced in the field, so they have an idea about what other people have done. But if it's a little bit out there, then they might miss things. And they do often miss things as well.
In an interesting conversation with a fellow called Chris Holt, out of the States, a lawyer and an entrepreneur in this kind of IP space, had a lot of interesting things to say, and we'll have him on the show. The different examiners, and not only whether they're overworked, but their different approaches and how willing they are to look deeper, and how you can manipulate that system for a favorable outcome. The success or failure of your application hinges quite a bit on that individual.
Unfortunately, that approach means that they do miss things, and the examiners tend to be quite zealous about some of the things which they find, which in hindsight can look only vaguely relevant. And so there are then arguments about getting the patent through because it doesn't meet these particular things. And so the inventor can overcome the objection, which might be slightly obscure, and differentiate it from the slightly obscure patent that they found to the citation, then the patent will be allowed. And that is where a lot of the issues come from, because the most relevant prior art is never found and never seen.
And this is related to that whole idea of the expert looking around, finding three things, oh, I'm different from this, I'm different from that, I'm different from that. We must have novelty here rather than a full picture.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, that doesn't make it good in the commercial sense, because by missing the prior art, it doesn't mean that that goes away.
It's a blind spot.
And so if somebody can come along and say, actually, this has all been done before, and here are the patents, and they were missed during the examination, then that can destroy the value in the IP. The other psychology of this, particularly from the inventor's perspective, is that a lot of investors see the existence of an patent application or a granted patent as a sign that they should put money into the invention, into the business or the startup or whatever. And that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But as a result of this way of thinking, that a lot of companies apply for patents without much thought to actually what they contain or what they're disclosing, but it's more about getting the next investment in or putting it in the next pitch so that they can...
A sales tool.
It is.
It becomes a sales tool rather than what the system was
it's
meant
a,
to be, which
token.
Is an elegant repository of all human knowledge.
Yep, absolutely. So that then means that the system, if you like, is cluttered with an awful lot of things that the patent should never have been granted in the first place. So.
Just to summarize a little bit about this story, the recycled plastic brick maker machine, when we look at this, we know what he knew. He's disclosing in his citations what patents he was aware of when he lodged this one. Yeah, but what we can't know is what the process of inventing that machine was like. It could be that they turned up, they could have done it back to front, not done the rigor up front before prototyping, and only learned about those other inventions when it came time to try to find out what IP there was to protect. Or that research may have been done and he may have built that machine in full knowledge of these other approaches. We know which one is more efficient, obviously, but not speculating on which way he went there. What's the moral of the story? Not in terms of just the process of the invention, but in terms of the patenting strategy, the dispute with the company, you know, there's just What's the moral of this story? What should we? How do you avoid these pitfalls? What's the right attitude?
It's a good question, Matt, and there's lots of answers. I think the moral of the story is, if you're going to spend money patenting something, then you need to have a view of your intellectual property and your ownership of what you think is your intellectual property, and attract the right investors and the right supporters that understand in full what the advantage is. And the second part, which we talk about always, is getting to market quickly, spending as little time as you can in the research phase and getting to where you need to be and competing in the market as quickly as possible. 20 years is a long, long time to not get into the market.
Yep, I'd say.
So, we've just been having a look through some of the older patents to look at the novelty aspects here. And as I've explained before, it's a really good idea to find the oldest things that you can. Mm. They tend to be the broadest in scope and simplest to read and simplest to interpret as well. So we found a patent for a machine for briquetting peat, so making blocks of peat, presumably for fires. And that's from 1924. It's got a US patent number 1490162. And reading this out here, the drawings look very similar. They've got a machine for compressing a block or a briquette in two directions, transverse to each other. And they've also got mention of a binding agent and a binding agent which softens, and also heating components, and in this case, actually a cooling component as well. So,
just to clarify, that seemed to be one of the core pieces of novelty, was that transverse directional pressure that was applied in the process.
It was, and if you remember as well, it wasn't specifically for thermoplastic. It had
a sufficient amount
of thermoplastic material in there, which could also mean this could have a sufficient amount of binder.
Yep.
And the fact that this binder goes soft when it's heated is, by definition, means it's the thermoplastic.
Right.
So it's not a molded thing. It's been changed in shape because it's softened due to heat.
And just to highlight that transverse is not a word that appeared in this one. It said at a right angle or at 90 degrees in this.
Yes. So there's two separate pistons in this, using hydraulics again. One is actually this thing that the briquettes are like a tube, so it's like a sausage going through an extruder or into a sausage machine.
Yep.
And it's got a piston which is not only forcing it through the tube, but it's got one that's compressing it from above as
right.
well.
Right. So if they were searching for transverse, it wouldn't have necessarily come up as a term because it's not used explicitly, which is just, I'm just trying to highlight that the search terms that you use massively impact what you find.
Absolutely. And pictures are worth a thousand words, as we know. So it's that's the idea of the snap, isn't it? Mm. We don't snap on words, we snap on pictures mostly. Mm-hmm. So that's good. So I'm just going to read out the introduction to this, or part of the description. So it says, this invention relates to machines for briquetting peat or similar material, and has for its object to provide a novel machine of this type, which operates to compress each charge of peat into briquette formation, so making the block or the briquette, and retain the pressure thereon for a predetermined length of time, and at the same time to subject said compressed mass of peat to heat, thereby to soften any binding ingredient in the peat so as to render such binding material active in binding the particles of the briquette together. So I think this wasn't cited in the granted patent, so it's uncited prior art.
Which was a long list of citations.
It was, yeah. They're never long enough.
did you find this by following one of the citations in one of those cited?
No, this is a research.
Okay.
Just really, I think I typed in thermoplastic and block and compactor. So this sort of compaction, this two-way compaction, is quite common. I think we mentioned before in trash compactors and scrap metal and these sorts of things.
Yep.
So you're trying to make a nice cube out of your vehicle at the end of its life. So you squash it and using rams from both sides.
Yep.
And so that's and we did find some other patents. We had a quick look here, and we'll put them up on people to see. But also methods of people to make hams using a compress and the heat to make a nice, nicely shaped ham with the indents on the end for the brand names and these sorts of things. And those are from back in the early 1900s too.
Great. That's a pretty darn clear snap.
Yep.
The next IP snap that we want to play is topical. We're all in the midst of a pandemic. And of course, it's in our best interest to try to reduce the spread of infection. We've all washed our hands ad nauseum and are squirting antiseptic onto our hands, the shops that we visit. But from the news, we have a funny little story where a scientist got some magnets stuck up his sinus and had to go into hospital. No, it wasn't a scientist. He was a doctor, I think. So he must have been.
He was a scientist.
Astrophysicist,
I think.
Oh, okay. Regardless, I hope he got some good ribbing from the doctors and his friends. Got some pretty strong magnets stuck up his nose. Now, we can infer from the fact that he had magnets in his nostrils that he was trying to give a wearable solution that you would have to have on a wrist, and in fact you'd have to have one on each wrist, otherwise you'd only be able to detect the touching of your face by one hand, and that because of the proximity of these the strength of these fields and the proximity problem of the length of your hand reaching towards your face, a necklace or something that was unobtrusive wouldn't suffice. So he was really trying to get this up into the face, and therefore the only place to hide them was in the two holes to be found in the nose. And so we can infer that he had a wristband and nose contraption to keep people from touching their face to reduce the spread of infection. So we've got the problem pretty well nailed, that people touch their faces and spread infections from their hands to their mucous membranes of their head. Technically, everyone has this problem. It would be curious to think about this from who is asking about whose problem it is. Is this about authorities fighting pandemics, or is this consumers themselves? How many people are saying, I wish I could figure out how to stop touching my face, and do they even know that that's a problem? So this is a tricky one to narrow down on to whose problem it is. But generally, we should put our effort into refining this a little bit. We shouldn't just cop out and say it's everyone's problem, because in a very practical way, it's impossible to reach everyone. You need to niche down to an audience in order to have any sort of reach and any sort of impact. What other solutions are there? Well, you could connect cables and cords to the wrist and then to another part of the body that would stop it from reaching your face. And I bet we'll be able to find some stuff like that pretty quick. But it seems like it would be problematic at best to wear stuff like that. Facial coverings in several forms, including masks, visors, cones of shame, like we put on dogs. I suppose we could walk around with cones on our necks. Gloves. And then my choice, which would be AI-powered cameras. So we have all kinds of cameras that can analyze your movement and already map the position of your joints and hands and give feedback, not just on whether you're touching your face, but on posture. A lot of problems there around people not wanting to be looked at by cameras. I'm sure there's some solutions around that. And then magnets, as we've seen, can lead to some ER visits. ED visits, depending on where you live. And our new solution is, let's look at this from the point of view that we're this astrophysicist trying to figure this out, and the solution that he's going for is a wearable on the wrist with a matched magnetic component in the nose. So let's kick off an IP snap. Computer, if you could give us 15 minutes on the clock. And we're off. Christian?
Excellent. So I'm going to load into the patents. I'll have a look and see if anything's come up here. Obviously, as Matt suggested, there's a whole lot of other applications that might be useful, and one off the top of my head is you know, stopping people's habits. So, you know, smoking, thumb sucking, these sorts of things where you're bringing your hand towards your face, and have probably been covered off significantly. Whether we'll find that somebody's put magnets up their nose is another a slightly different thing, and we're obviously aware that there's a good reasons for not putting things up your nose, particularly with small children.
Please don't try this at home or anywhere else.
Have a look. So yeah, so just putting it in a pretty basic search terms into Google Patents, there's a relatively recent patent here, which is called Method and System for Preventing Virus-Related Obesity and Obesity-Related Diseases. That sounds probably, is it maybe an overeating aspect? And it's a method here, and then it talks about infection. Preventing obesity-related infection by an adipogenic adenovirus, but it might look completely irrelevant at the moment. But further down in the abstract, it says providing the person with at least one sensor positioned to detect when a person's hand approaches a predetermined distance from the person's face.
Now it's becoming clearer.
By warning the person of undesired hand-to-face contacts, the person is able to reduce the incidence of obesity-related infections.
I've already worked around it, though. You could get one of those hats that has the slots for the two cans, and you could fill them with maple syrup and just have a straw to your mouth. So calories achieved.
I'll download this patent and stick it in the answer, because there is a picture of a cap in here, but I don't think it's got the cans, Matt.
Oh, darn it. Well, they wouldn't want to put it in their invention. This is the magic bullet that destroys the efficacy of their invention.
So this is talking about the principle. So I'll just...
There's lots of... The art actually covers a lot of components. Necklace, helmet, shirt collar, sunglasses. What's going on here, Christian?
So they also have in there, if you look at that, this is lodged by a company called No Hands LLC, limited liability company in the States. Patents in the States, and their patents which they've cited, so this is the ones that they've told that they know about, cover off. So they go back, so these are nicely put in date order, which is good, and they've covers off the earlier ones again. The
hand near mouth warning device. I mean, yes. How much clearer does that get? Now, I just want to say that I find it super cool that you did this search and you're digging in one that handles obesity. And I just want to remind everybody, this is what it really looks like. If you're not experienced at this, or you don't really work on the assumption that there is something out there, you might look at this and go, that's not it, and you might move on. But
absolutely.
The entire wealth of the knowledge that you need in order to know what's going on and what has been done in the past is right here in this obesity-related diseases one. Definitely.
And if you look through the patent citations of that particular one, the earliest one here is a thumb-sucking preventer, so that's something like we talked about. Second one, 1974, means to assist a person in overcoming habits. Another one here, self-injurious behavior inhibiting system, so people who are self-harming themselves. Personnel security, another thumb-sucking one.
Which we could filter depending on, you know,
again, hand near mouth warning device.
Yep. That's the one I was just looking
sleep
at.
Sleep apnea collar. So that's another.
The hand near mouth warning device one describes just a kind of a strap on the wrist with, I mean, it looks sort of like an old calculator watch with a three-axis attitude sensor, which would be achieved by the modern Apple watches and other smart watches, but you'd have to have one on both wrists because you need to be able to detect both hands, not just one. Either one can spread it.
And if we hop on the interactive jewelry one, I had a look at that. That's something that is a bit abandoned, so it's got the ring on the finger. So it's saying interactive jewelry watches and accessories which, when placed in proximity to other pieces of light, interactive jewelry watches or accessories will respond with visual, audible, electromagnetic and or mechanical response notification. So they've got a whole list of jewelry things, some of the things I've never heard of probably. Watches, keychains, hair pieces, body piercing components. So maybe the guy with the magnets in his nose is a body piercing component, because I think he did use people have used those for studs and things.
So a nose ring. Because he had two magnets, so he may have been actually trying to hold it on the outside of the.
He may have been, I think he may have done the from memory of the article, he may have not been able to pull one out, so he decided to put another one in.
Do not.
It's a bit like, you know, sending people down a mine and they're not coming out, and so you
send some more
in to look for them.
Don't try this at home or anywhere else, people. Okay, are we snapped?
I
reckon if we can, before we jump the gun on that, if we just try to look at it from his perspective, that he was trying to use some magnets to detect the proximity of some wearable on the wrist and some wearable on the nose, that this jewelry, interactive jewelry one, in combination with this application around viruses, should have gives me the confidence to say we've won IP Snap. Excellent. Any besides the comic value of this, any insights that this brings up that we haven't brought up before?
It demonstrates, I think, the one is, it doesn't matter who you are, that ideas can come from anywhere.
Bad ideas can come from anywhere.
it isn't mostly about the ideas, it's about the actions, and it's the point in which you're taking the actions to trial this. If you like something that obviously resulted in something quite humorous and could have been quite serious, and I think the guy had to go to hospital in lockdown to have these things removed at the hospital. So the very action that he did was causing
further danger to himself and the staff.
To himself, absolutely, and the staff and everything else. So it's just another illustration that it's possible to understand a little bit about the context by doing a little bit of research. And as a scientist, you kind of expect somebody to kind of do the research first before poking things up his nose.
Before human trials.
That's right.
Here at Invented Again, we don't ask you to do anything we don't do ourselves. We treat our idea about doing this show the same way we treat your submitted ideas. Although we have a lot of experience innovating and helping others solve problems, we are beginners when it comes to podcasts. We're totally making this up as we go, And through our failures, we discover better and clearer ways of expressing what we think is true and important to innovators. And innovators are a critical part of a healthy civilization and planet. As we stumble along, principles are emerging, and it is these gems that I will pause and explore. Here's a couple that strike me after playing IP Snap with young Otto today. When innovating, be as curious as a child. Each of us has an endless supply of questions when we're young, but we often learn to stop asking them because grown-ups are supposed to have the answers. Don't trust your gut. We're wired to trust our gut. It's survival instinct, but only the facts matter. Your idea will almost always feel new, but this is almost certainly due to gaps in your knowledge. It is highly unlikely that it has not been thought of and recorded before, at least in part. Be grateful for the wealth of knowledge we've inherited. Realize the value of the enormous and detailed record of human accomplishments that we call the global stock of knowledge, including patents, articles, scientific papers, books, videos, and more. Get excited when you discover that your idea has been expressed before. It means that not only were you as insightful as those bright sparks that came before you, you can stand on their shoulders and quickly reach higher than you could from scratch. Don't fear running out of ideas. Humanity will never run out of problems, so we will never run out of ideas to solve them. Be honest with yourself and others. When we have an idea, it's easy to see it as a part of who we are. This could be called identifying with your idea, and this can cause us to ignore facts even if we don't realize it. Good ideas can come from anywhere. Who we are doesn't matter. It's all about the process. But this doesn't mean we don't value ideators who haven't made a novel contribution yet. Anyone who shows interest in being an entrepreneur should have every opportunity to practice the skills required in a startup, collaborating, prototyping, making a business case, and overcoming the million other challenges involved, even when the core idea is not new. But we should consider this education, not innovation. Be frugal. There are lots of ways of expressing this. Fail fast, use lean methodologies, iterate, pivot. But underlying all of these is the basic mindset that resources are precious. Your time on Earth especially. And we should spend as little time as possible testing each idea before committing to one. Unfortunately, this is exactly the opposite message sent by the New Zealand government's drive to increase R&D spending to 2% GDP. And my last principle today, be content with exploiting existing ideas. Stop obsessing about what is new and what isn't. Let your love for your fellow humans and your desire to solve their problems be your motivation, instead of letting your ego trap you in its desire to be first. You are important and unique regardless of your timing. Get out there and solve problems, and you will create yourself a life worth living. That's all the time we have today for Invented Again. I want to thank Dr. Christian Slack for coming in and talking with us today.
Great to be here, Matt, and great to talk to you guys who are listening. Hopefully this will encourage you to have lots and lots of ideas. I think the message that we need to put out there is that you need to be prolific. Don't have all your eggs in one basket, and we'll get success much, much more quickly if we do that.
And we can help you do that if you come along to InventItAgain.com and submit your ideas. Thanks for listening.